You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hello, Bill.
Good morning, Matt.
Welcome to the DMZ, everybody. Our first post-Philadelphia show. And wow, it seems like a million years ago that the conventions happened, but how are you recovered yet?
I'm not recovered. I was getting home. I mean, I wasn't partying. I was just the process of getting from the Wells Fargo Arena back to where I was staying. It took me a couple hours. Right. So I wasn't getting home until 2 o'clock in the morning.
Well, come on, Bill. We know that you were out partying and getting high with celebrities and Lena Dunham and you don't have to disguise it. We know how it goes at these conventions.
Yeah, well, how it goes is I'd eat a big cheesesteak at 2 o'clock. I'd get to the arena at 4. I wouldn't leave my seat for 7.5 hours. It would take me an hour to get out of the arena on the subway to the parking lot and then another hour to drive home. That is the glamour of going to the Democratic National Convention.
So you're saying that it wasn't like Rob Lowe circa 1988? That it's slightly different.
Rob Lowe had a different agenda than I did at the convention. And now look where he is today.
Yeah, the kid landed on his feet. I was mostly holed up in the Mount Laurel, the Westin in Mount Laurel, New Jersey. So
yeah, I don't get your strategy. Why you don't want to be in the arena for these things? I don't get.
Well, you know what? You know, I think I think that. I probably should, and maybe next time I will. I do sort of subscribe to the Bob Novak theory of debates, which is to say the best place to watch a debate is at home on TV, because you're consuming it the way normal people are. And so if you're going to watch a convention speech and you want to consume it the way normal people do, you would watch it on TV.
Yeah, well, the way normal people consume it now is the day after in small snippets while they're goofing off at work.
Yeah. So. Well, I do think
you're not going
to
do that.
Just for my own, just to have the experience of being in the hall when something historic happens, Hillary Clinton. For example, I would say if you could pick one thing you should have been at, it wouldn't be the speech. It might be the roll call vote where Hillary Clinton became the nominee.
Well, the roll call vote was, more interesting than usual because it wasn't just a perfunctory reciting of what was already known to be the case. There still was this level of tension and drama. What are the Bernie supporters going to do? I mean, that was the whole week, was that it starts off on this very discordant note, and then as you sit in the hall 7 hours a day, 4 days in a row, you feel the mood of the room change.
And what people don't realize is that Bill actually wore Depends undergarments. So he was literally never left his seat the entire time.
I left my seat, I think, maybe once or twice. And I regret it both times. I missed the Mothers of the Movement because I went to get a terrible pork sandwich. That was a very bad call. But you could feel that, as we talked about last week, the Sarah Silverman comment, the roll call, combined with what we know was a very active campaign by the Sanders and Clinton people to marginalize and shout over the hecklers. You really felt a shift in the level of unity in the room. I mean, it never got to 100%, of course, but it was more so on Thursday than Monday. And I watched some things afterwards when I got home on TV to see what it was like for the average person, how much was the heckling obvious on TV, that sort of thing. And I felt that the con speech was more powerful in the room than on TV. I mean, there's a number of things that are more powerful on TV because in the crowd noise, you miss stuff.
Which is saying a lot, because it was powerful on TV. So the fact that it was...
I thought when he held up the Constitution and said, I will gladly lend you my copy, I felt there was a bigger jolt in the room than you pick up on TV. Like, I thought the cheering on TV was kind of steady. And whereas in the right, there was a real second blast when he did that. And I mean, that's, I mean, and at the moment, I didn't necessarily assume that was going to be the indelible memory of the convention, because a lot of times these undercard speeches are forgotten because you
Right,
remember
this
the big speech,
happened,
you remember anything at all.
was this like an 8 o'clock? Something like that?
It was, I think it was nine, I think it was 8 or 9 o'clock. It's the way it wasn't 10 p.m. when most people are
Right,
watching.
right.
I mean, I have a vague memory of 2008 when the Democrats, found a guy named Barney Smith to say it's time for the government to care more about Barney Smith than Smith Barney, which was considered a real, a real
Well,
clever moment for an undercard, regular person speech. But now almost nobody remembers that even happened,
yeah, I mean, I think
and
the best analogy is the Patricia Smith speech at the Republican convention. This is the mother of someone who was killed in Benghazi. She blames Hillary Clinton, and I thought she gave a very compelling and emotional speech, which did not come anywhere near the con speech in terms of the media coverage. But the irony, of course, is that Fox News has complained about that or brought that up, and Fox News did not even carry her speech. They do you know about this, Bill?
Well, because Trump went on Bill
Yes.
O'Reilly, right?
So, like, she gave this very emotional speech about, how her son died in Benghazi and how she blames Hillary Clinton, and Fox News didn't even show it. So it's hard to blame the liberal media for suppressing.
That would not have happened if Roger Ailes was still around.
Is he still? Has he officially left yet? I'm unclear. Has he actually?
Well, he's a consultant now,
Okay.
right?
Well, that's a whole nother. Well, we could do a whole show just on that.
But yeah, but even not being watched live, I think, I mean, there's two things. One, Trump kept alive the con story. I mean, if Trump didn't
Yeah.
say anything, if Trump just or gave something, I mean, I think Hillary was asked about Patricia Smith and she said something, showing her respect to her and then pivoting towards, her role in Benghazi, but not directly attacking her as a human. Whereas Trump, gets into a 4-day tangle with Khan almost unprovoked, and extends the life of the story. I mean, number one, and I think number two, Patricia Smith's charge against Hillary is highly dubious that she was actively lying. I mean, Hillary has gone through the ringer on Benghazi. There's things to criticize about Benghazi. There's things to criticize about the balance of security there. I mean, I don't think it's a cut and dry debate because you don't want your diplomats to be in a bunker because then they can't diplomat. That's the tough call that the State Department has to deal with when you're dealing with the diplomacy in high risk areas. But there is things to say about the security, but to say that Hillary is an active liar and lied to her face
Yeah.
when there's plenty of other Benghazi families that don't say that. Chris Stevens's family doesn't say
Right.
that.
No, I could,
That's not.
well, I completely agree with you that Trump made this story, gave this story legs. And I believe, and I don't think this is an I mean, I think this is pretty obvious that he was set up, that Trump fell for a trap that was laid. I mean, the Democrats found somebody who really was the most sympathetic possible person you could imagine to attack him, and he couldn't. They knew that he couldn't resist attacking back. So I think that
Well, and
they
also
laid a
that, I mean,
trap for him, and
just
he fell for it.
well, just to contrast with Patricia Smith, I mean, Khan's basic point was more of a universal truth. You cannot discriminate against people on their religion based on the United States Constitution. I mean, that's just a fact. I mean, there's a political element to it, of course, the way he turned the knife into Trump, accused him of not having read the Constitution. But then again, Trump has talked about reading Article 12 of the Constitution, so it's not on totally baseless ground there. And Trump's counterattack isn't on the merits of the argument; it's just an ad hominem attack.
Yeah.
So everything about
But I
it,
still think that the substance isn't the most important part. It's that you have a Gold Star family who, I mean, occupy this, I mean, deservedly so, have the moral high ground. And are almost unimpeachable, barring some major revelation that is yet to emerge.
But attacking them is
a loser. I mean, you just don't do it, no matter the merits. Right. No matter the merits, it wouldn't work.
But Patricia Smith holds a similar status. She lost a loved one in a war scenario, and she doesn't get the same. She's like getting showered with media coverage now. I mean, partly it's because of Hillary's response to her was more diplomatic, but partly because the merits of what she is saying aren't as strong.
Well, I will concede that that she may not have as much of the substance on her side as the cons do, but I think the disparity in terms of coverage, both qualitatively and quantitatively, has more to do with other factors, including the response of Hillary versus Trump, the fact that Fox News didn't cover Patricia Smith's speech, and the story of somebody, a rich guy, a rich vulgarian like Donald Trump, attacking a family whose son volunteered to serve our country, and then gave the ultimate sacrifice. So, I think that there's, I don't think the substantive part is the what drives the media. I think emotion almost always trumps logic in these cases.
So we're after the convention. Fox News has it now at a 10-point lead for Clinton.
They've always been in the tank for Clinton, Bill.
CBS was a 6-point lead. We saw a Pennsylvania poll today. It was Clinton up by 11. There's a New Hampshire poll, Clinton up 15, also dragging down the Senate candidate there, Kelly Ayotte. Now she's behind the Democrat, Maggie Hassan, by 10. I saw a poll of Clinton up in Arizona by a few. So is this just convention bounce, which often can be ephemeral? Or is there a deeper, cratering of Trump here? I had a piece before the convention at Real Clear Politics that was titled Clinton Aims for a Landslide. I wasn't predicting a landslide, although everyone sort of treated it as if I was. My point with the piece was that the way Clinton is pivoting post-primary, I think people saw it more clearly during the convention, essentially predicting this is what she was going to do, reaching out to those Never Trump Republicans, national security hawks, Michael Bloomberg independents, etc. She is trying to build a very broad, maybe not deep, but broad coalition where she could win by upwards of 10 points. I said, it seems that Trump has a ceiling of about 45. Looking at the polls over the past year in the Real Clear Politics polling average, he has never hit 45. Now, the day after I wrote that, he got his little convention bounce and he hit 45.7 in the average. He had a couple of polls where he was hitting around in the upper 40s, which is rare for him. And so a bunch of conservatives and Trump fans got on my feed saying that I'm a hack. Can I not read Real Clear Politics graphs, all that kind of stuff. But of course, now his average is back below 45 again. Is there a real ceiling? Obviously, people said he had a ceiling in the primary, and that wasn't true. But you look at his primary polling, it generally goes up and up and up over the course of the year. We now have over a year of general election polling where it does not go up and up and up. It hovers around the low 40s with a couple of spikes into 44, 45 a few times. So are we at a place in the race where he's just stuck, his perception in the public is baked, and this is not going to be close? Or do you think he's got another few tricks up his sleeve that he can make this competitive?
Well, I think a few things. Number one, I think that, obviously general elections are different than primaries and for a variety of reasons. I think that the electorate is very different. And it's probably true that Donald Trump learned the wrong lessons from the primaries. It's probably also true that a lot of us in the media were chastened by overestimating the Republican base and underestimating Donald Trump's appeal to them. And so we're hesitant to write him off in a general election. Maybe there was something magical happening. I always said it was magic versus math was basically how I looked at this race. I do think that there are a few caveats. One, I think that the media does have something to do with this. I think the media helped build Donald Trump up in the primary. I think the media is now tearing him down. But I think it is in the media's best interest for this to be a close race, or at least a race that we all pretend is close. And so that will be a factor, I suspect, which could have consequences, keeping Trump in the game. Nobody wants to say the race is over today and declare it over. And then that has a self-fulfilling prophecy sort of effect sometimes. I also think that because we have an electoral college, not a popular vote, that is something we really need to be careful of. I mean, I think that it's, you know, certainly within the realm of possibility that Hillary wins the popular vote, but that Trump finds a way to win in the electoral college. I mean, I wouldn't bet on
it. Now he's losing Pennsylvania by 11 points.
Again, I wouldn't bet on it, but I think it's within the realm of possibility. Having said that, you know, it's really amazing how what has happened to the Republican Party. If only someone had written a book warning about this a year ago, maybe they.
Hey, it's your fault. You published in late January. That was too late.
Actually, I agree with you. I think we should have published sooner. I mean, the book. We're coming up on the anniversary of when I finished the draft. You know, basically the final draft of the book. And
you need to get on a horse like Paul Revere and start just tossing manuscripts out to voters in New Hampshire.
And the way the publishing world works is, you know, it's a slow process. And I actually think we would have sold even more books if it had come out sooner, because. I think the problem was that when the book came out, even though I had been way ahead of the curve and seen the problems with the Republican Party and the conservative movement, when the book came out right before the Iowa caucuses, it became clear to a lot of people that there were fundamental problems within conservatism and that Trump very well could be the nominee. And all of a sudden, I think everybody started writing about this topic, about these topics. And so there I am with my book out, but I'm competing against free copy by every smart writer in America, whether it were Ryan Lizza, Chris Saliza, any Lizza, anybody whose name ends in Lizza, Jonathan Chait, Bill Scher. Everybody got in my turf and started writing, like, what happened to the Republican Party? Max Boot had a piece out. I didn't read it. In the Washington Post this week, now granted, this is months after my book came out, arguing about how the Republican Party's anti-intellectualism led to this. It's like, yeah, who would have thunk it, right? who would have guessed it? I think it was a New York Times op-ed, actually. So, I mean, anyway, enough bitching about that.
Well, so here you are, conservative intellectual Matt Lewis.
Oh, yeah.
Prophesized the intellectual collapse of the Republican Party. He's watching it disintegrate before his eyes. This week, you have two pieces that I've read. One saying that you can't vote for Gary Johnson if you are a conservative, even if you are a libertarian, you feel he's not a good libertarian.
True.
in your view.
True.
And you also write a column for Roll Call. Saying, don't leave the Republican Party.
True.
Even if you're mad at Trump, don't abandon the party yet. There's still good to be preserved. Let's work to save it. Does this mean if you can't vote for Gary Johnson, you can't vote for Hillary, you can't vote for Jill Stein, you
well, now,
want
wait
to
a minute.
Save the Republican Party?
You could vote for Jill Stein. If you want to make sure.
Oh, okay. Is that where you're landing right now? You're
gonna go I just Jill talked, Stein? I just talked to a Republican strategist who's voting for Jill Stein to make sure the Green Party stays on the, you know, gets on the ballot in the future. I'm okay. Right now, I'm at the, which sounds almost sacrilegious or unpatriotic, but I'm at the do not vote for anybody. Don't even vote. This would be the first election. I mean, Bill, I vote for dog catcher. I vote for county commission and city count. I vote for every election, mainly because my wife makes me. But I voted certainly in every presidential election since 1992. And this may be the first one that I don't vote in. And I tell you why, because if I decide, and who knows, there's time I could change my mind. But the good thing about not voting is it's the only way to prove that I didn't vote for Trump or Hillary, is that, you know, you can't prove who you voted for or who you voted against, but you can prove whether or not you voted. That's a matter of public record. So I may not vote at all just to be able to say it, to prove that I didn't succumb to the siren song of Donald Trump.
That just seems wrong.
It does seem wrong.
You have to vote.
Something about it seems wrong. But you don't have to vote.
Down ballot races.
You don't have to.
I mean, aren't there local races you need to vote for?
I don't think there's anything on the bubble right now. I mean, in Virginia, remember, I live in Virginia and the Commonwealth. The gubernatorial elections are in odd years. I live in the People's Republic of Alexandria, so I don't know that Matt Lewis's vote is going to be consequential this time in the state of Virginia. But
you never, if there's some poor schmo out there running for a register of deeds and he loses by one vote because Matt Lewis had to make some point that nobody cared about.
I agree. Look, I agree that it seems, I'll concede it seems wrong. I think that we might like fetishize voting. I'm not convinced on the merits that what I'm doing is not quietly heroic. In fact, I think, you know, I think I may be a hero here. I'm not sure.
You can take a photo of your ballot.
That may be illegal.
In the booth. Yeah, you can still do it.
You're advocating that I potentially violate the law?
I'm saying you have it in your back pocket. If someone's ready to challenge you, what you really did, you can have it there and you can show that person.
Well, anyway, we've got time. My mind could be changed. I could end up voting for somebody. But the piece in Roll Call, I just wanted to point out, I think Gary Johnson is an idiot. At least, what a golden opportunity that he's two former Republican governors get the Libertarian nomination. And, you know, they're not even good Libertarians. I mean, I would be okay if they were just down, you know, if they...
So how are they not Libertarian?
Well, I mean, recently, Bill Weld was asked about sort of his model for Supreme Court justice, and he mentions Breyer, who certainly is not, you know, anything that you would consider to be Libertarian. If the Supreme Court's important to you, he didn't say Scalia. but I think that the thing with Gary Johnson is the religious liberty issue. So look, I'm not saying libertarianism is right or wrong. Like, you could easily reject libertarianism and say that it's wrong, it's unconscionable, it's immoral, it's amoral, it's anarchical, like whatever. But if you are a libertarian, the position is to defend religious liberty, which means not using the force of government to force somebody to bake a cake. But Gary Johnson is okay with that. He's okay with that. He's okay with forcing the Little Sisters of the Poor to pay for contraception. And again, I'm not saying that that's, you know, you could certainly make a compelling argument that, you know, equal protection under the law and good civil rights and sitting at lunch counter. You could make that argument, but not if you're a libertarian. Like, libertarians by definition are, like, believe in individual liberty and eschew those arguments. And so Gary Johnson religious liberty is like in the First Amendment. Gary Johnson doesn't even support that. So my point is like.
Well, I remember at the convention, they had a debate at the Libertarian Convention, and they were asked, do you support the 1964 Civil Rights Act? And Gary Johnson said yes and got booed.
Yeah, right.
But I mean, can't you make a libertarian argument? Obviously, it's a different brand of libertarianism, but to say we think that to have anti-discrimination legislation is necessary so everybody can pursue their own liberty. I mean, you might still disagree with it because you're taking the sort of absolutist religious liberty side of that debate. But does that fundamentally make him a bad libertarian that he has a different interpretation of it?
Well, then libertarianism ultimately comes to mean nothing. Yes, you could make a tortured effort to do that. But fundamentally, my point is this. And Jonah Goldberg, he said this. I think it was in response to conservatives voting for Hillary. But he said on Twitter, I'm upset because somebody to my left took over the Republican Party. Why would I respond to that by then voting for somebody else even farther to my left? And I just think that Gary Johnson is missing a golden opportunity. I mean, from a political standpoint, if Rand Paul were the Libertarian nominee, I think he would get 20% of the vote easily. Maybe more. I would be supporting Rand Paul. And I've never been a big Rand Paul fan, but there are a lot of disaffected conservatives and Republicans out there who would love to have somebody just minimally acceptable that they could in good conscience support. And Gary Johnson has two former Republican governors have this nomination and are not providing us with that opportunity. It's unbelievable. I mean, it just highlights what a horrible year this is, that not only do we have two bad choices, we have four bad choices.
Well, because the social conservatives have no home. I mean, that's the real issue here. If you're primarily an economic conservative, Gary Johnson fits perfectly with you.
Yeah, but Ron Paul, but even Ron Paul and Rand Paul would be fine in that if you were a...
Well, they're more socially conservative.
Yeah, but they're also, I mean, Ron Paul got the Libertarian nomination two or three times, I think, for president. It's not crazy to think.
There's plenty of people that say it's not libertarian for Ron Paul to be anti-abortion, because he's not being libertarian when it comes to women's reproductive choices.
But I think that
there's a libertarian strain that says,
yeah, no, I think you're right about that. I think that when it comes to abortion, that is an issue where I think, understandably, libertarians are torn, because on one hand, you could argue, we are protecting the individual, the baby's right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And we are protecting that baby from governmental or whatever, sort of impinging on their right, fundamental right to life. And you could also, as a libertarian, say, no, this is a woman's body. How can government pass a law to prevent her to do whatever she wants with it? So I think that may be the one issue where good libertarians could disagree on that one. But it would be nice if Republicans, if considering the fact that Ron Paul, at least twice in my lifetime, has been the Libertarian nominee for president, it would be nice if all of a sudden, if it just happened to coincide with the one time I might actually consider voting for Ron Paul.
Although Gary Johnson's probably going to do a lot better than Ron Paul ever did as a Libertarian.
Because of Trump and Hillary, because of the situation. It's not because Gary Johnson's a great...
I think more because of Trump. But in part, yeah. But so if economic conservatism is your main concern, Gary Johnson's a comfortable place to go. If national security conservatism is your concern, Hillary Clinton's a comfortable place to go. She may not be as conservative as you would like, but she at least has more inclination to military intervention than Trump or Johnson or Stein does. It's the social conservatism that social conservatives that are politically homeless right now. So you're Matt Lewis, and you're stuck on those grounds. But you're telling me that you have to at least acknowledge that no one's perfect for you, and you could do the opt out and not vote. But for those who don't believe that's really a choice, so you have to vote. Are Gary Johnson's transgressions to orthodox conservatism equivalent to Donald Trump's?
Neither of them are worthy of my vote. Neither of them, I can't support either of them in good conscience.
Now, there's an ad called I think it's called Confessions of a Conservative, if I remember the title correctly. This is an ad that was done against Goldwater in '64 that went viral again this year. because everything that he was saying about Goldwater in that ad seemed to track what you would say about Trump. The Clinton campaign, actually, I think Rachel Maddow tracked down the person that was the actor in that ad, although he's a professional actor, but he was speaking his own mind in that ad. The Clinton campaign tracks her down, cuts a new ad with the same guy saying many of the exact same things. And one of the things that he says in the ad to close is, I thought about not voting, but that would mean that I don't care who wins, and I do care. So deep down, Matt, do you care who wins? Or does it really not matter to you if it's Clinton, Trump, Johnson, or Stein?
This is like one of those psychological things where, like, you know, which boat do you, there's a boat full of like children and then a boat with your wife in it, and you have to decide like which one sinks, you know, or which one you save, or you know what I'm talking about, Bill? And my thing is, I'm gonna wash my hand right now. I could change my mind. And by the way, remember, I mean, just for those who are fans of the show, and there's millions of you out there, you may remember a show not that long ago where I was, you know, Johnson curious. I was contemplating supporting Gary Johnson because I'm impressed by his you know, like some of the stuff he's done, the marathons. I think didn't he like climb Mount Everest or something? I mean, just individually an interesting guy. I think maybe he might have smoked a little bit too much weed, but anyway, so it's not like I've always been out to get Gary Johnson, but upon further review, this is where I landed. So I'm basically at the point of saying there are no good options. I wash my hands of this. Like, I do not want
You're ducking my question.
I do not want to personally responsibility.
Do you care who wins?
Do I care who wins? I think what I've done...
If Hillary beats Trump, yeah. Does a part of your soul say, we avoided Trump?
Okay, I don't... Part of me would. Absolutely, part of me would. Here's the fundamental point. I put it in God's hands. I don't know which is worse. I do not know which is worse. Because it's possible that it is the best for America and for the Republican Party and for the conservative movement for Trump to go down in flames. On the other hand, I don't want to be responsible for having anything to do with Hillary Clinton and the three or four Supreme Court justices she's going to appoint. There are no good options. I think it's honorable to sit this one out. Like, I don't think that you have a moral obligation to pick your poison, to pick the lesser of two evils. Maybe I may change my mind on that. I mean, you know, everybody now is, of course, citing the Hamilton musical, you know, and there's the one, Dear Mr. Hamilton, if you had to choose. And ultimately, Hamilton concludes that Jefferson has beliefs, Burr has none. Right. Maybe someday I say Hillary has beliefs, Trump has none. I mean, you know, we're not there yet. I'm like Paul Ryan and Donald Trump. I'm not there yet. but I would say I voted in every election since 92. I do reject the notion that it is dishonorable not to vote. I don't accept that notion.
I think something's going to go on between now and November with conservatives where there's been this three-decade narrative of Hillary Clinton as a supreme evil being, which is at best highly exaggerated. Obviously, people can disagree about, you know, basic political positions, but I think there's a character there that goes, you know, beyond the facts at hand. And I think there's going to be some gut checking going on, saying, okay, is she really as bad as we have made her out to be all this time? Obviously, I disagree with her because she's in the opposite party, has a different philosophy than I do.
Well, there may be another thing happening too, though.
Toxically awful.
My mom, this is totally anecdotal. My mom just saw that Dinesh D'Souza movie, and she's now voting for Trump. Like, it scared her so much about Hillary Clinton. I haven't seen it,
but it's that kind of propaganda. Let's face it.
I haven't seen it. I can only imagine.
I'm going to go out on a limb and say that Dinesh D'Souza's documentary is propaganda. I mean, all that stuff, I think some conservatives are going to say, okay, maybe we got a little out of hand there. She's not as bad as all that. She's preferable to Trump. Let's get back to reality here. I think this might be a real moment of reckoning for the conservative movement, how they've operated for so long, and if they need to return to a more grounded place. Now, you have this piece where you say, you know, let's not leave the Republican Party. This is salvageable.
Yeah.
You know, I wrote a piece in February for the New Republic called The Case for Shutting Down the Republican Party, that this base is fundamentally split down the middle between the bigoted who want to deport Muslims and immigrants, ban Muslims from coming at all, and those that don't. And there's polling data to show that's a real split inside the Republican Party, and this is a breach that you can't repair. The folks on the bigoted side of the coin cannot be a base of a functioning, modern, competitive national party. So you got to rebuild on a different basis.
Okay.
You are saying the Republican Party can be saved. How can it be saved?
So, as much as I respect you, Bill, and as much as I know that you are intellectually honest, deep down, you do have a conflict of interest when it comes to giving Republicans advice. And so I'm just always, that's part of the reason I wrote Too Dumb to Fail, is that, you know, it's a conservative. And by the way, Bill, everybody knows Bill was very helpful in helping me write that book. But I, you know, I thought it was important to come from somebody who is a conservative, who sincerely wants to preserve the conservative movement and the Republican Party. I mean, I don't really consider myself a partisan. I live in Virginia, where you don't even have party registration. I definitely consider myself much more of an ideologue than a partisan. But having said that, I think that it's, you know, we just see these stories of people leaving the Republican Party, and I just think it's premature. We don't know how it's going to shake out. It is possible that Trumpism, whether he wins or loses, prevails, and this becomes the party of Trump, not Reagan or Lincoln, but Trump. And in which case, I do think it's fair to say that it's untenable to stay a part of this party. That then there will be a schism, and it's irreparable. But I don't think we're there yet. I mean, the party nominated Donald Trump. It's possible that Trumpism, that the Republican Party is sort of de-Trumpified. It's possible that he's...
Well, how do you cleanse it? Let's say Trump loses by 5 or 10 points.
Yeah.
Is there going to be a faction of Republicans that says Trump was a disaster, anti-immigration as a position is a disaster, and we need to expunge this from the party going forward?
Well, let me say, Bill, a very wise man once told me that a political party has to lose 3 elections before they have their come-to-Jesus moment.
Right.
So this
I think it's going to happen. Right. I mean, I think they're going to have that debate. What I don't easily foresee is convincing a very sizable faction of the party, half or near half, that seems completely immovable on these questions of immigration and Islam. How do you get the upper hand in that debate internally when that faction is so large and seemingly impervious to reason?
Well, look, I think that's going to be a real challenge. I think, number one, it's probably important that Trump loses by a large margin. The closer it is, the harder it is to de-Trumpify the party, the harder it is to discredit Trumpism. So, you know, this becomes the ethical question then. Is it better to vote for Trump or not to vote for Trump?
That reasoning you just laid out is a reason for you to actively vote for Hillary and expand the margin.
It could be. I mean, this is really a game theory thing. There's ethical questions. It's strategic. It's very difficult what we're going through. I also think that it's just important for opinion leaders to try to frame the election. And we'll see. Does Rush Limbaugh, for example, frame it as Trump would have won had the Never Trump movement gotten on board? Is it the establishment's fault that Trump lost and elected Hillary? Or does the narrative become Republicans had a golden opportunity to win the presidency and they pissed it away by nominating the one guy who couldn't beat Hillary Clinton? So, I mean, that, you know, this is going to be a fight over a narrative, and it's going to be partly decided by conservative opinion leaders and partly by the margin of victory or loss. But it's going to be a struggle to define the narrative, what happened. But I do think, as you've said, Bill, that sometimes it takes a party three losses before they have their come to Jesus moment. So here's my point. Let's see how it shakes out before we abandon the party. Let's see how it shakes out before we abandon it.
After Democrats lost in 80, 84, and 88, a lot of the left said, okay, we got to nominate somebody who's pro-death penalty and pro-welfare cuts. So be it. You know, if that's what we got to do to win an election, I guess that's what we got to do. I don't see the Trump faction getting to a place where they say, okay, well, we just have to let all the immigrants in to win an election. I guess I'm going to go do that. I think the folks who don't believe that will speak more loudly after losing three times.
Yeah, but you're misrepresenting
the other side.
You're misrepresenting the mainstream conservative point, though. I mean, I don't believe we should let all the immigrants in to win the election either. I mean,
I'm saying how what those folks will say to
you. Yeah, but I mean, so, you know, maybe it's. I mean, here's the other thing too. It's possible that Trump's gone and we move to Ted Cruz. You know. Which has its own problems. And I think Cruz, I would vote for Cruz. If Cruz were on the ballot, I'd vote for him. He's a real conservative. But I don't, and I do think he would run a much better campaign in terms of organization. His team clearly understands data and voter turnout. But from a messaging standpoint, he would need to change to be viable. But so the Republican Party is going to have a lot of problems going forward. But part of my argument is that these problems didn't happen overnight. They won't be fixed overnight. But if the Republicans in the base decide that reforms need to happen, you're not going to be if you have fled and abandoned the party, then you will not have the right or the authority to help lead them to the promised land. So if you want to be part of the solution, you can't abandon them. Now, you also can't support Trump. I think what you have to do is preserve your integrity and your character by distancing yourself from Trump, but also preserve your right to be part of the future by not leaving the party. Now, there may come a time when it becomes very clear that the Republican Party is unsavable and untenable, but I don't think we're there yet.
Okay, so I got to run. I'm running a little late. I'm going to give you one last suggestion before we go. I think what you want to do then is organize a campaign to write in a particular name that captures what you think the Republican Party should be. I mean, everybody writes in the ghost of Ronald Reagan or something, you know, and they make it a thing that everyone's doing that, and then you have something demonstrable on election day to say, here is the faction of the right that you lost on election day, because otherwise it's going to scatter to the winds between Hillary and Johnson or not voting or random write-ins.
Not a bad idea. Let's have our secret vast right-wing conspiracy meeting and get that done.
All right. Always going to talk to you, Matt Lewis. Check out, I didn't even talk about the piece I had in the New Republic this week, which is about how the left has to save populism from Donald Trump. So go check that piece out and check out Matt's pieces in Roll Call and Daily Caller on how he's gonna stick around and not vote for Gary Johnson. And we'll talk next week.
All right. See you guys. Thanks, Bill.
Thanks for listening to Blogging Heads TV. You can help support this content by remembering to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. You can subscribe to all Blogging Heads episodes or to a specific program by going to our subscribe page at bloggingheads.tv/subscribe. There you can sign up for podcast downloads via iTunes or Stitcher, or you can subscribe to our email and we'll send you an alert every time we post a new episode.